The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Hi, everybody. My name is Gabe Keller Flores, and I work here at Common Ground. And I'd like to welcome everyone for this special evening with Heather Lynn Mann. We're really happy to have you here. Heather, for those of you who don't know, is an environmental activist, advocate from Madison. Also, mindfulness teacher. She founded and led the nonprofit Center for Resilient Cities, which mobilized inner city residents to restore natural beauty in damaged neighborhood landscapes. And she'll be speaking on the subject of a book that she has written about a 6-year voyage, 15,000 nautical mile voyage. And her talk tonight is called The Voyage from Despair to Hope in 2017. Really happy to have you here, Heather. And she'll start by leading us in a 30-minute meditation.
I feel compelled to just say out loud what a special place this is. And you know, I started to catch on when we were walking from the parking lot past the beautiful plantings, the gardens, and then seeing the clarity of Gabe's smile as I walked in the door. And then coming in here and the solidity of your peace and practice. Thank you very much for including me this evening in this. It's lovely. I think what I'd like to do tonight is start with a story, and it is a way at getting at some of the things that I'd like to talk about. I think that stories can be pretty penetrating. My husband and I were very privileged to have an opportunity to take a sabbatical for many years and live on a sloop, a sailboat, on the Western Atlantic in the Caribbean Sea. And on this particular night, we were in a place in the Bahamas called Tulu Key. And we knew that a storm was coming and that the wind would be moving its location and that eventually it would be a perfect spot to anchor. But, you know, we were a little early, and as we were trying to anchor, the wind blew us toward the shore. And does anybody sail in the group? You do? Okay. And you probably know that that was our first mistake, that we were anchoring in a place that was blowing us towards shore. But when we got done anchoring, we looked around and we said, well, we're too close. This is uncomfortable. We need to be further out. So I was at the helm, and my husband went up to the bow, and we always took turns, you know, with our jobs. And I went to push the throttle forward, and as I did that, the engine stayed flat. It didn't rev. And I had no control over the ship. And so I called my husband back, and I showed him what was happening. And the blood drained from his face, and he ran up to the bow, and he threw out a second anchor. And the problem was that the land underneath the water was mostly rock, and it just had a fine layer of sand on top, but it looked like sand. But what was happening was that the anchors weren't able to penetrate and hold us, so that as the wind was blowing and the bow was bouncing, our boat was inching backwards toward the land, even closer. And I turned and looked what was behind me, and it was a shelf of rock that was hanging out over the water. It was carved away underneath, and it was razor sharp and about hull height. And I knew that as we were inching back, we were very likely going to be puncturing our hull and really hurting ourselves in the process of trying to save the ship. And it was about this time that I noticed that my body was being sort of overwhelmed by a wave of fear. And I was having a hard time thinking straight. And I noticed that my limbs were really heavy and felt like they were thick. And I thought, well, can we sail into the wind and tack our way out? And I realized that we couldn't because of the contours of the land under the water. And so I said to my husband, should we get a tow? We need somebody to pull us away from land. And he said, yeah, I think we do, because we are at risk of harming ourselves and our boat. And the Bahamian Sea Air and Rescue people are there for this very reason. So yeah, let's get a tow. So I go below decks, and I find the phone, and I find the phone number, and I dial it. And the phone rings and rings and rings, and I realize that it's 5 p.m. on New Year's Eve, and no one in the Bahamas is going to come to our rescue. So let me fast forward a few hours. We're still in the same situation, but now the sun is set and the storm is really raging. And we were taking turns on anchor watch, and my husband was actually below deck studying the manuals, and I was above decks, and I had a spotlight on my lap, and every 15 minutes I would turn around and shine it behind me to see if we had lost significant ground and just had to do something. And it was raining sideways, and the canvas was just rattling, and the wind was blowing so hard that it was creating like a screaming sound through the rigging. I was, at this point, like horror film spooked. I could no longer judge whether I was safe or not, and I sat there and I had every article of clothing on that I owned because I was freezing. And I decided, I realized that in 15 minutes it was my husband's turn to come up, and he would take a look at where we were, and he'd have fresh eyes, and he'd know what to do. And so I decided that in those last 15 minutes I would just leave the spotlight off and I would breathe. And I would try to get a grip, and I just sat there quietly, and sure enough, at the top of the hour, he came up the companionway ladder, and he says, hey, baby, how's it going? And I said to him, I don't know, I stopped looking. And in that moment, when I said that, I knew that I had let myself down, that this was my boat, that this was my choice to be here, that it was my life, and that I had checked out. And I realized that there was something actually far worse than my fear, and that was my willful ignorance. And so I said, I'm sorry, I just have to go below decks. I've got to, you know, get control. I'm just really, you know, beside myself here. And he nodded. He was very kind. He says, okay, go ahead. And so I went below decks. And let me just read for you a passage of what happens next. Resting in bed with eyes closed and Dave on watch, I feel the ship's untamed motion from a new vantage. Sloshing reverberates inside the hull with the acoustics of a giant cello. I scan my body yet again, curious to find how it feels when I'm deeply frightened. Steel-tight shoulders, twitchy fingers, rapid, shallow breaths, queasiness, aching temples, and a tickling unsteadiness in the back of my knees. Poor thing, I mumble out loud to myself. You were raised on land in a field of safety. You don't know what to do. I wrap my arms around my middle and give my body a hug. My attention drifts to a conversation some months back. Have you scared yourself yet? Our boat broker, Tom Harney, asked me. We had crossed paths in Florida some months after buying our ship Wild Hare. No, not really, I remarked. Dave concurred. We've gotten into some pickles, but we've gotten ourselves out of them again, I boast. Well, then you haven't been sailing yet. You haven't really been sailing until you've been really scared. I guess tonight, more than a year into our planned 5-year voyage aboard Wild Hare, is my first real sail. I laugh. Sailing is horrible. My mind floats to a story the Buddha once told. A young girl ran from a pair of snarling tigers through the forest. She fled for her life, but stopped short at the edge of a steep cliff. And there, with a thud of cat's paws approaching from behind, she climbed over the edge to dangle from a broken tree branch. The tigers caught up and paced above her head at the cliff's edge. In an unfortunate turn, three more tigers arrived to circle below her perch, and they too were ravenous. The girl could not climb up. She could not drop down. But beside her, she saw a single strawberry growing from a crack in the cliff. It was plump and ruby red. So what did she do? She ate the strawberry, free from fear of what would happen next, and in the full awareness of the beauty and the safety of this present moment. Tonight, the story of Tiger's rings of spiritual discipline, a determination stirs in my core to experience the richness of life here and now, even in the company of my fear. Yes, I am afraid, but I am other things too. I am safe in this moment. The boat is sound. Danger is present, but the future has yet to be determined. This understanding changes something in my middle. A pressure lightens. This particular chapter, I think, is a good example of the experience. Because, you know, these things would happen at sea, these pretty dramatic events. And I made sense out of them through the lens of Eastern psychology and Buddhist teaching. And I had, for many years, been a practitioner. I had, in 2006, a year before we went on the sailing voyage, been ordained in the core community of Thich Nhat Hanh's, the Order of Interbeing. And it was how I thought and how I felt. And this particular experience of breathing in the fear, the strong emotion, and breathing out compassion, you're probably aware that that's the ancient practice of Tonglen. That we breathe in the sensation of whatever the strong emotion is, whether it's fear or anger or even our own hatred towards others, we breathe in that sensation. And in the instant that we do, we transform it into compassion for ourselves, for the people around us, and for our society. You know, poor thing. You don't know what to do in this situation. And in that moment, suddenly the story of the tigers, a story that I was very familiar with, was able to rise in my consciousness. And everything shifted. So I had been an environmental advocate for many years. I had founded an organization in Madison that worked statewide. We would acquire land in cities that had been contaminated by industrial use. We would clean it up and then work with local residents and ask them, what kind of a neighborhood do you want to raise your children in? What should we do here? And together we would design places of community vitality, centerpieces of beauty. And it was incredibly meaningful work, and I loved it, and I loved the people that I worked with. But I have to say that over time, as I was in my career, I realized that the environment was actually much worse off than when I started. And this thing kept coming into my consciousness, this notion of climate change. And at first when I did, I was thinking to myself, well, somebody has to do something about that because that sounds horrible. And I actually kept it at pretty much an intellectual distance for quite some time. But after a while, you know, using this as a metaphor, I realized that I hadn't really understood the climate crisis until I'd been really afraid. And I needed to just sit and breathe with the reality of that and let it inform my actions. And one day when I was in quite a bit of despair because I was no longer sure that my work was right on target with what I needed to be doing, I felt that there was a change that needed to happen, but I had no idea what to do. My husband came home and he said, I think we've saved enough money. I think we can actually go on that sabbatical that we've always planned on. You see, years ago when we were dating, we used to walk hand in hand through marina piers and oogle at the different boats. and dream someday of where we would go. And the fact was that neither one of us sailed. We had no idea what we were talking about. But we would imagine, you know, what the different rigging was for. And we would consider where we would go someday, what we would do. And then when he asked me this question, it's like, well, yes, I want to go. But I'm an activist. I'm engaged. How can I just sail over the horizon? You know, that didn't feel right. So I decided that I would take with me a question. And that question was, how am I to be in a suffering world? What am I to do? And I would take that question straight to nature. And I suspected that I would get a very different answer from my experience in nature than I would from anything society would have to tell me. And in this particular night, the answer that I got was, I need to be fearless, even in the company of my fear. Because the bottom line is, when I am racked by fear and I am sluggish and can't think straight, I am really horrible crew. You know, I shut down. I don't bring my whole self and my imagination and my creativity to the challenges at hand. So let's fast forward a few years now. And different night, different story. We're back, still in the Bahamas. It's a different area of the Bahamas. We're in the Berry Island group. And we happen to know that there's going to be two storms that are blowing through, one right after another. So the funny thing is that when storms come through the Bahamas, that usually the eye of the storm goes right over the islands. And so what happens is, first the wind comes from the northwest, and then it swings around in the northeast, and then it comes from the south, and you know, it makes a full circle. And so if you're on anchor, your boat is going to swing 360 degrees. So you need protection on all sides. So we had found this perfect place to anchor. We had just this ring of islands around us, and we were right in the middle. And the first storm blew through, and we were safe and happy. And 18 hours later, the second storm was blowing through, and we had just finished dinner, and we were sitting below decks watching the television series Lost on DVD. And all of a sudden, the boat goes bam, bam! And we jump out of our seats, and we go upstairs and look. And our ship had blown onto an island, and it was jammed into the rocks, and we couldn't drive off. So this actually wasn't the worst thing in the world, because it was almost low tide. And what you can do is one of you gets in the inflatable dinghy, and the other passes the anchor, and it drives off, and then you drop the anchor off to the side of the boat, and you bring the line back, you wrap it around the winch, and as the tide rises, you just lift yourself up and off the rocks. And so we start the drill. My husband gets in the dinghy, and I pass him the anchor. And unfortunately, there was this other thing going on, which was that we were having some trouble with our outboard motor. And it had started when we were up in Annapolis, and we kept trying to fix it and talking with technical support hotlines. And every time we thought it was fixed, it would choke and die again. And you know, so we'd work on it some more, and then, it's fixed now, and no, it would choke and die. And so on this particular night, my husband gets in the dinghy, I pass him the anchor, he drives off, and a wave hits the inflatable, and it bounces oddly, and the anchor falls out in completely the wrong place. And the outboard engine dies, and I'm standing there on the boat as I'm watching my husband, you know, ring, ding, 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 ring, ding, ding, like that. And the wind blows him in the dinghy past the ship and between the islands and out into the Atlantic. And I realize that where I am, the seas are about 3 foot, but out there, they're 13 feet and greater. And I close my eyes and I think, well, where are we? What does the chart look like? And I realize there are no more islands. His next stop is Africa. And I say, well, you know, what has he got? Does he have any of the safety gear? And I look at my feet, And there is the supply box for the dinghy, which includes the radio and the life jackets and the paddle. And so I decide that I'm going to stand there and count to 10 and think if there's anything I should be doing in that moment other than issuing a mayday. And as I'm counting, I just look at what's happening. And the really funny thing I see is that it's absolutely beautiful out. That there's this giant moon, and it's just hanging in the sky here, and it's lighting everything up like daylight. And I look to my right, and there's this wall of clouds that just towers above me, and it's undulating. But it's not raining. It's just blowing really hard. And the words of my Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh, come to me, and it's, this is because that is, and this is because that is, and this is because that is, that there's just this great causal stream, and that, you know, the boat, the wind blew the boat blew on the land, the husband got in the dinghy, you know, this is because that is, and there was no one and nothing to blame. And in that moment, I wanted to shake my fist and blame somebody for what was going on. But it was just a causal stream. And then one more thought came to me, that as far as I could see, and I could see for miles, as far as I could see, there was only one being present who could choose how to respond. And that was about when I got to 10. And I decided to issue a mayday. So I went below decks, and I picked up the microphone for the local VHF radio. It's about a 12-mile radius. And I picked up the microphone for the single sideband or ham radio, and I depressed both buttons, and I said, "Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is sailing vessel Wild Hare, Wild Hare, Wild Hare. We are at," and I read off our latitude and longitude. And then I had to think of one sentence that describe the nature of my distress. And I said, "Our ship has blown onto the island. One person is on board, and the other person has blown out to sea an inflatable dinghy. Mayday, mayday, mayday." And there was no answer. And I called again and waited, and I called again and waited, and there was just silence. And so I changed the distress frequency, and I called again, and I called again, and there was never an answer. And so I won't tell you what happens next, but I will say this, that several days later, my husband and I are aboard our ship Wild Hare, and we're sailing now to a populated area. And as we pull into this harbor with this marina, all these dinghies start going, "Oh, it's Wild Hare! Wild Hare, everybody! They're here!" And we were suddenly bombarded by, you know, dozens and dozens of inflatable dinghies, and they're all, ew, ew, you know, bouncing into our hull and squeaking on each other. And they said, "Are all crew present and accounted for?" And I'm like, "Oh, you heard me!" And they're like, "Yes, we heard you. You were ripping out our hearts." And I said, "Oh, but you couldn't come because it was too dangerous." And they said, "No, nobody should have been out on that night. We would have put ourselves in danger." And I said, "Oh, of course." And then the marina operator came up and he said, "Did they find you?" And I said, "Who?" And he said, "Basra, the Bahamian Air and Sea Rescue. They went looking." And I said, "Why didn't they find me? I gave the latitude and longitude. That's within 3 feet. And he said, "I don't know." And he drove away. And then the nice thing about being in a harbor like that is you get Wi-Fi. And so I downloaded my inbox, and suddenly I had hundreds of emails. And they all had subject headings with things like, "Are you dead?" and "Phone home." And from our daughter, "WTF." And I started reading and putting together this story that what happened on that night when I had that ham radio depressed and I was going through the frequencies. My voice went up into the ionosphere and came down, and it skipped the Bahamas. and it skipped the East Coast, and it skipped the continental United States, and it was heard one time by the U.S. Coast Guard station in Kodiak, Alaska. And they recorded it, but it was garbled, and they only got a partial position statement. And so they sent out a rescue boat 20 miles off from where we actually were. Now, you know, these stories in the book, there's the experience and then there's these reflections, and it took me a while to really understand what happened on that night. But what really helped me make sense out of what happened was the teachings of Joanna Macy. And I don't know if you've had a chance to read her work, but she writes about active hope. And in particular, she like pulls it apart from passive hope by saying, you know, passive hope is what we normally think of. It's that, you know, sitting at home and wishing for things to be different. And that does absolutely no good for anyone. But active hope has three qualities. And these are the qualities that absolutely the U.S. Coast Guard embodied on that night. The first is that you monitor reality. And the Coast Guard is always listening to what's happening. And the second quality is that you get really clear about the future you want to manifest. And the future that the Coast Guard wants to manifest is safety at sea. And so they organize to prepare for that. And then the third quality of active hope is that when it's time, you do the simple thing in front of you that there is to do. You act. And you spend absolutely no time thinking about whether you're optimistic or pessimistic about whether or not it's all going to work out. You just act. So on this night, they started a search and rescue case. And it was amazing the way that they did their detective work. It ended up touching just about every life that we knew, every one of our friends and family. And so when I was standing there feeling so alone, I had no idea that I was caught in Indra's net. So I also like to think that on that night, I, in contrast to the woman in the first chapter who was too scared to lift that spotlight off up her lap and look, that I did embody active hope on that night. I stood there and I monitored what was going on and I saw what was happening and what was, you know, going to happen. And I was really clear about the future that I wanted to manifest. I wanted to save my husband. And so I did the only thing in front of me that there was to do, which was radio for help. This particular chapter is entitled Power. And I'd like to share with you just a few paragraphs about why. In some ways, I was powerless when the inflatable dinghy blew between the islands with Dave on board. There was no controlling the storm, the slipped anchor, or the faulty outboard motor. It was impossible for me to reach my man to save him, and at that point, I had no influence over the circumstances leading to the crisis. In other ways, however, I wasn't powerless. I still had dominion over my own actions. My radio call set into motion a rescue mission that didn't stop until I brought it to an end days later. In the great stream of cause and effect, I had the capacity to mobilize tremendous resources in support of my preferred outcome. Evolution, it seems, has given me and others in my species the rare and wonderful gifts of awareness, volition or clear aspiration, and choice. And although these qualities don't give us power over nature, others, or circumstance, they do give us the spiritual power to act. Humans can cultivate healing and well-being anytime and anywhere. Almost magically, the powers of awareness, volition, and choice originate from within and don't require anything in particular from outside conditions. Awareness, volition, and choice are superpowers. In the midst of my Mayday call, I aspired for something inherently good, a goal that others like the U.S. Coast Guard wanted to, and by tapping into the synergy of collective aspiration, my influence to make a difference sprouted faster than kelp. The power of my choice also got a boost from a willingness to do something small, radio for help, even when the action appeared in the thick of things to be fruitless. This leads me to believe that even the tiniest deed set into motion can spark a revolution. So I spent a few years writing this, and the publication date moved around a little bit, and then they announced to me that it was going to come out on November 8th. And you may recall that that was Election Day. And I at first thought that that was somewhat of a coincidence, but this book is a sailor's voyage from despair to hope. And on that day, we either woke up to our own journey of despair to hope, or we woke up to the fact that there were an awful lot of people already in despair that we were just unaware of. And each of these chapters is a partial lesson in how we're to be in this world at this time, fearless and practicing active hope, you know, not sitting at home and wanting things to be different, but actually beginning to join with others in ways that are coming from a place of compassion and kindness. I had an experience when we went 15 days offshore from Jacksonville, Florida to St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And it was grueling. And it was just the two of us, and so, you know, we ended up hallucinating and, you know, getting exhausted, and every time the sails were set just right, the weather would shift and we'd have to do something different, and every time the weather was lousy, suddenly it would get great, and then when the storm was really raging, the next thing we know, we were completely becalmed, and there was just this constant ebb and flow of life, and suddenly impermanence became very tangible, that every time you get something set, it shifts. And this world is constantly dynamic. But the good news of that story is that the fact that it's dynamic is the opportunity for us to continually create the world we want. So impermanence is a gift. And it also means that we can't just sit back on our heels, but we have to keep adjusting and keep trying to manifest the world we want to bring about. And when we live our life in such a way that we are manifesting the peace and well-being that we want someday in the future, when we live that here and now, suddenly we experience the world that we want in the present moment. And it ends up having ripple effects with ourselves and the people around us, and that is the nature of transformation. And I tell you, I don't really have a right to be here before you today, because the very last story in the book, it was an experience of something that we had done several times, and we approached it. We had been sailing for 6 years. We approached it like the experts that we thought we were, but the world was slightly different, and that difference was the thing that put us in great peril. And I don't know how we survived that experience, but I write about that chapter as the importance of beginner's mind. That it is our own expertise and our own sort of unconscious, yeah, things are kind of rolling along like they've always been, that actually is a source of great danger for us. And if we live in this world today, assuming that it's like the world that we grew up in, then we're not doing ourselves any benefit. We must stay awake to the present moment and keep digesting that. So, like all good stories, there comes a time when it's time to come back to land and return. And I tell you, I was quite concerned I knew that I had been transformed by this experience of the sea. And I knew that if I came back and joined the nonprofit again and got back, that I would be sort of overrun by these old habit energies. And I didn't want to slide back into that frustrated woman again. So I made myself a list. And that list was the things that I was no longer willing to do. And I knew as I wrote it, actually, that it would make me completely unemployable. I was no longer willing to make enemies, be angry, be ambitious, blame others, rush, exaggerate or spin my message, work long hours, or even argue my case. And that last one was interesting because when I came back and I started talking with people again about some of these issues and somebody would say something that wasn't quite right or that I could correct them on, I'd go, and I stopped and I said, who is that person? Because I hadn't done that in 6 years, that leaning forward, that sharp inhale, that wagging of the finger. And I shut my mouth and I decided that I would listen for twice as long as I thought I would speak. And lo and behold, 9 times out of 10, I realized that the misperception was my own, or that what I was about to say was actually not going to be at all helpful. So because I wanted to practice active hope and not only just, you know, identify the world I don't want to manifest, I wanted to identify what I did want to bring about, I made myself a second list. And that list is that as an activist, I want to make friends, cultivate happiness and share my joy with others, work in small and simple ways, look deeply into the roots of conflict, past the storylines to what's really going on, proceed peacefully, being mindful not only of what's out there, but what's going on in here, speak plainly and accurately, play with loved ones and in community, and listen and share. So this is my first foray back into advocacy again. And I invite you to take a look. It's a quiet invitation to actually be somewhat entertained, reflect upon what has happened in this experience, and then also each chapter ends with a meditation that is a way of really reflecting whether these themes make sense to you in your life. So another thing that I did is I started contacting people within the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition and saying, you know, how are we as a community going to keep Thay's teachings alive? He's had a stroke. He's no longer writing his books. But he's left us this legacy of teachings about our interbeing and interdependence with the natural world. And it's beautiful. And very soon, you know, after these conversations started, within less than a year, a global organization was born within this global community of practice that's called the Earthholder Sangha. And not only do we want to take our peace and well-being that we have on our cushion out into the world, but we want to embrace the world as a teaching and a giant Dharma door, and continually help each other and ourselves wake up to our interdependence and the beauty of that. And so here's something, if you'd like to write a nice note, a love letter actually, to President Trump to help keep America great by staying in the Paris Climate Agreement, you can add your name and address to this and put it in the mail, and he'll get it. Someone will. And we have some of these that you can have after the talk. So I'm going to stop talking right now. And I'd like to invite your questions. I'd like to invite your sharing if there's an experience that you've had, a teaching from nature. So thank you.
And if you don't mind, we'll use the mic. I can bring it to you, and this will be be on the recording so that others can hear your thoughts and Heather's response. So who'd like to begin?
I'm curious about going through such a extreme experience, what you went through on the boat. How did that change your relationship with your husband? I'm just curious, as you went in as one person and came out as another, along with someone else, and I'm just be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
That's a very perceptive question. So my husband and I had a lot of harmony in our relationship to begin with, and we raised children, and he had his big job, and I had my big job, and then we got to sharing 45 feet of space 24/7, and there was some, butting heads, because he was in charge of people, and I had been in charge of people, and there are multiple ways to do things on a boat, and so... One day I was I'd had it. I was just, and anger doesn't do me any good. So I went to the back of the boat. I opened up this like trunk space, this lazarette, and I pulled everything out of it. And I sat inside and I just breathed. And it took about an hour. And then my husband comes out finally and he goes, "Heather, where are you?" I said, "I'm in my office." And that was a good transition point, because up until then we had both kind of been trying to do everything. And from that point forward, we started really looking at playing to each other's strengths and knowing that he has certain gifts that are tremendous and I have certain gifts that are very valuable. And the harmony on the boat improved considerably. And then one day we had this experience about... I won't go into any details about it because it's another wonderful story, but it really woke me up to this incredible privilege that it is to go through life with another person, to have a shared history. And there's really something quite profound about voyaging like this, where you are absolutely taking care of each other and no one else is. And, you get hurt, and the other person has to step up. And then they get hurt, and you step up. And that kind of a partnership, it really was quite profound. So, I'd say the love deepened. They always say boats are a great way to test a relationship, because it'll either, make it clear you don't belong together or that you do. And for those couples that do, they make the best cruising pair, because usually in the couple there's an optimist and a pessimist, and the optimist gets you off the pier and the pessimist brings you back. So there's this wonderful dance, that was really just a delight to discover. So, yeah, thank you. It too was a voyage.
Hello, my name is John, and my daughter Mariana is here too. And Keith and I got to experience a week with Thich Nhat Hanh back in 1989, I think, with the Environmental Defense Fund for a whole week with environmentalists. And it was wonderful to hear the quietness in our minds at the end of the week. And now Kaya and others here at Common Ground are looking at creating a climate change conversation, maybe quarterly or monthly, and we would love to have any of you interested sign up on a sheet so we could try to find people who want to get it going. But we're curious, with the Earthholder Sangha that you and Keith are part of, what are the Sangha community practices, what are individual practices, and what are the collective action practices that you do, and how could Common Ground become part of that?
Thank you. One of the things that we've had the opportunity to do in a collaboration is put together a 110-page practice manual for earth holding and protecting. And it has in it Dharma talks, it has in it ceremonies, it has instructions for having flash sits. It has, you know, potluck opportunities. It is just a really great way for sanghas to begin to think a little out of the box for what it means to practice outdoors, to awaken to really our great togetherness with Earth. And so that's one thing. I would encourage you to go online to earthholder.org, and you'll be able to find that practice manual. It's a draft. If you have comments, there's an opportunity to offer comments and improvements. Please forgive the typos. We also have retreats that we do, and there is another retreat coming up in this fall that is you'll find on the website. It'll be down in Santa Fe, and it'll be led by the monastics that are touring from Plum Village in France. And so that'll be very special. I think that you're right about wanting to practice with a sangha. That one of my favorite lines from Bill McKibben is somebody asked him once, what can I do as an individual? And his response was, well, first thing is stop thinking like an individual. So our sanghas are really powerful instruments to help us wake up and to help us stay on the path. And this is going to be a pretty rough path. So we need to go together. And in this practice manual, you'll find a wonderful document. It's called the Earth Peace Treaty, which are ways that you can begin to reflect about bringing your own lifestyle into alignment with ways of healing and protecting the earth. So there is no divide between our inner world and our outer world. And part of the way of caring for the earth is to really care for ourselves. And as we go forward, you know, that's what makes the Sangha such a perfect unit of moving forward, because we're learning how to take care of ourselves in any given moment. And we're very lucky to be able to do that. People need us to bring our peace and our solidity into this conversation. People need our clarity and our sanity. Just to add to that, one of the opportunities I had as I was sailing was I would make appointments with colleagues in the islands. And one fellow in particular, his name was Crafton Isaacs, and he was down in Grenada, which is near Venezuela. And I would just ask these colleagues, you know, how is it for you here? What do you know about climate change? What does your community, your population know? And what are your governments up to? And there were a number of answers, but one thing that really stood out for me, particularly since the election, was Crafton Isaac's comment. He said, you know, Heather, nothing will change until Middle America wakes up to the fact that it too is being exploited by capitalism. And I thought after the election for the first time that what we're seeing is Middle America waking up to the fact that it's being exploited. Unfortunately, there are powers that be that are controlling the narrative, and they're making the exploitation the fault of other people who are different from us. And what we can do as a community of practitioners is to help reframe the conversation so that it's not about blaming, you know, people from other countries or people who look different, but it's really about the system itself. A system of capitalism that has been quite happy, thriving by exploiting people and landscapes. And now the world is suddenly too small for that to continue. So I don't think that what is happening is all bad. One of the monastics that I spoke with in Blue Cliff Monastery in our tradition said, this is our karma. We have to respect our karma. We have to embrace it and work with it. And so this is our moment as people who are stable and clear to act. Thank you. We have time for a few more questions.
Just back to your actual sailing. How much instruction did you get before you took off? How good do you have to be, or, you know?
So my husband said, as he was reading this book that I'm writing, he goes, oh, Heather, they're going to just think we're such bad sailors. This is 13 events out of, 6 years, so there are a lot of good days. We had taken many sailing classes over the years. We had kept boats on the inland lakes in Madison, and we had chartered boats in the islands, with captains. When we bought our boat, we hired a captain for the first week, mostly to learn the systems, because, your plumbing system, your electrical system, it's very complex. And that was very helpful. But the bottom line is we didn't know what we didn't know. And what we did, it ended up being pretty smart, was the first couple of years we would be coastal sailors, where we'd pretty much always sail within sight of land. Or we would cross the Gulf Stream and go into the Bahamas and back. And once we got ourselves more practiced, and then our ship, we were constantly improving. And once we got it, with the upgraded electronics and all that, then we were ready to go. And then that was, you take baby steps and you make mistakes, and then you go, I'm not going to do that again. And then you do past the reach of like rescue, or past the length of time where you get accurate weather predictions, and then you have a different set of challenges. So, yeah, there was always something. There's suffering everywhere. But I would encourage people to sail. I hope that this book doesn't discourage anyone, because the opportunity to dance with nature like that, to figure out how to harmonize in ways that are... I was so used to getting in a car, turning the key, stepping on the gas, driving a route, arriving on time, that whole process of letting go of my agenda and letting the world dictate whether or not I could even leave the anchorage on any given day, it really puts things into perspective. And I started to realize how much hubris I was bringing to my relationship with the natural world, because we can afford it. We live in, these environments we've designed. But putting ourselves into a place where we need to figure out a new way to harmonize, I think that's really healthy, and that's absolutely what's called for at these times. Our own inconvenience is the point. Sure, yes. Letting go of my activist nature. Busy mind, deadlines, grand plans. I think part of it was going out into the ocean and having a grand plan and totally getting... Well, it's actually quite accurate because you would go out and you'd get spanked, and it would be very much like that. So I had to let go of my grand plans in nature. Yeah, I think I saw the playful feet running away. Also, there was a time when, a couple years into our journey, when I woke up one morning and I was in deep grief, and I realized I didn't do enough. I wasn't skillful enough. I didn't do nearly what I had set out to do in my career. How could I be doing what I was doing? And I was just like locked in this profound grief. And then I sat with that for quite a while, and pretty soon I realized that that notion that I was the one that was going to fix the problem, that was all just based in ego. And that was when I was really able to start letting go of these activist habits that I had, that nobody actually assigned me the job of saving the world. And that that thing that sometimes we carry as activists is pretty ridiculous. And it's based in a real misperception that that's even possible and that you would be the one to do it. And that really what this is about is being in relationship. And being in relationship in a deep and meaningful way is an act of letting go. Because you have to go as a river, as our teacher always says. You are one drop. But you have to combine all the drops together for the river to have the momentum to get to the sea. Because one drop will never make it. All right. Is there one more question? Yes.
Hi, Heather. Thank you for being here. My name is Bruce. Nature has us, as you spoke about, the harmony that it brings us out to experience when we're in it. It allows us to be in the moment. As an activist who is in the field, constantly working with the organization to bring awareness, to bring change, to bring about climate change, you had the opportunity to go out into the wilderness, into the natural world. What you knew in the field, as we call it, in your work, and then going into on the boat, were you able to verify and see the climate change that you so often would speak about? Because it seems as though until we realize it firsthand, will we actually do anything about it?
Thank you. One of the places that we went to was called Buck Island, and it was off of St. Thomas. And all the guidebooks said, oh, idyllic coral reef. Absolutely must do. So, you know, I had scuba equipment, and we did a kind of combination scubaing, snorkeling, and went into the water, and all the coral was dead and broken. And it was tragic because it was like a boneyard of these giant pieces that were once alive. And what we realized was that, you know, one of the hurricanes that had blown through had just smashed, because of the wave action, this entire reef that was certainly 100 years old anyway. And there was other times when we would come across coral like that. Once when we were hiking Grenada, we were way up in the mountains, And there were these historical images of the ravages of yet another hurricane that had come through. And it completely denuded the island, where, you know, this lush vegetation was nothing but stalks. Part of what the conversation also with Kraft and Isaac said is he asked me, you know, in Grenada, who is going to pay for the kinds of adaptations that we need to do as an island? Because we really have two choices. One is that if we have to pay and nobody else does, we will either become, consume our resources overnight, like Haiti is the example he used, or we will become a diaspora. And so part of what I was seeing about climate change was the fragility of these cultures that are there and how their small economies are not going to be able to survive. And then even here in the United States, we visited a place called Tangier Island in the Chesapeake, which you may be aware of. It's where John Smith first landed. And people got off the boats and lived there, and they have this accent that supposedly is English, but I can't decipher any of the words, and it's part Cockney and it's part Southern, and they have their own food, and they've always made a living there from the water. They're called watermen. And the island, because a meteor hit this particular place near the Chesapeake and opened up, so it turned into a bay instead of just a river, and opened up the Chesapeake into a bay. But the reverberation of the impact from long ago now has the island in sinking mode. And so it's sinking as sea level is rising, and the island is a third of the size that it was just a short time ago. And because of the nature of the non-point source pollution in the Chesapeake, they've made it illegal to fish 5 months out of the year. So for the first time in 400 years, no graduating high school senior is going to become a waterman. And that culture is disappearing right here in the United States. It's considered to be one of the most vulnerable communities, along with the Maldives and, you know, islands in Louisiana. So that's what we saw. And it's hard. But part of the hard is bringing joy right up to it and taking care of ourselves and realizing everything that is still going well and that is still beautiful. And, you know, there is love and there is life and there is laughter. And we need to have a diet of as much of that as we do of the pain so that we can persist. And that is really the nature of self-care, to persist. So thank you. I think it's time that we bring our conversation to an end.
I just would like to say one thing, and it's true. I know you meant that, but I just...
I did, yes. But thank you for giving voice to that, because I believe that down to my toes.
I figured you did, but I just yes. put words in here, too.
Yes, thank you. And actually, there's three roles that we can play as an activist. First is to get out there on the front line and just stop harm. That's a really important thing, but that's also where there's a lot of burnout and where sometimes a lot of ego is. And so we have to guard against that, and we have to be aware that, you know, that is really grueling work. The second kind of activism is to create alternatives. So we don't have to, for example, just have fossil fuel. We can have other alternative energies. And then the third is that we can work towards transformation. And that is really about helping people understand deeply what is happening so that we don't have to buck heads so much and do the push-pull, that more people will be come to appreciate our great togetherness, and there'll be a little bit more ease. So I do appreciate you saying that. Thank you. All right. Well, shall I invite the sound of the bell and bring our evening to a close? All right. And I want to really thank you very much for your time and your engagement with the world. I'm going to try to do my best to take care of what's within my reach, and I trust you to take care of what's in your reach, and together that will be enough. So, thank you.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.